Now entering Nerdist.com.
I'm so glad we were able to finally do this. My schedule sucks, and your schedule sucks for doing this kind of stuff. And so we had it almost happened, and then it didn't, and then yeah. But here we are.
Yeah.
The important thing is we're here now.
Exactly.
So
power of now.
Welcome. The power of now.
The power of now.
This is now.
Very much
we are
so.
In it. But now is then.
Yeah.
Now so is now, though.
Now, right now is now.
Now is now. But now it's then.
And now is gone. Now was gone, but yeah, technically now is now.
But it's coming back. Here it comes. And
it's
now.
Here it is again.
But now it's gone.
And it's special, but then it's gone.
I'm enjoying now. Now I've enjoyed now. Then what happens?
I'm also going to enjoy the future now, which is right now.
Listen, it's a bunch of thens and future nows.
Yeah.
That's really all it is.
It's just so fast. It moves so fast. It's hard to say what now is really now.
I don't know what now is. I'm feeling it. But now it's gone. It's so ridiculous. Well, it's an interesting. This is a particularly interesting time to be talking about that. Just considering that, you know, I think I don't know if what's your do you have a normal work year or is it
the normal work year is a really fast paced traveling schedule.
Yeah. Because you probably work a lot. You probably work a ton. I know you work a ton all the time, but New Year's is probably pretty big for you.
Oh yeah. New Year's is like that's the big day for all the artists, all the DJs.
Yeah.
So but I mean sometimes I go to tropical places, sometimes I go to different countries, but this time I'm just going to Miami.
All right. Where are you
from?
Which
will be good. Yeah.
Right. Where's my mom is from too. I lived there when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I lived in Miami.
It's interesting. It's different. It's different than California.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. Still a lot of Spanish there spoken.
Yeah,
just
it's
Cuban.
That's what's similar. That's
just Cuban Spanish.
It's a similar but different. It's like it's like this is Mexican Spanish.
Yeah.
And that's Cuban Spanish.
Cuban Spanish is so fast, I think, as compared to the Spanish, but as opposed to the sort of the Mexican dialect, I feel like. Cuban Spanish sounds so fast.
It's all so fast to me, anyways.
Yeah. But most people are kind of in this mode of, all right, I just got to get through one more week and then I can shut down. And I'll probably get sick for 3 days, and then I can finish out the year.
Yeah, yeah. It's like that's Las Vegas every weekend.
Oh, it is.
And that's where I technically live.
So, oh, you do.
Yeah. But I'm the one. I'm more of the observer. I'm the voyeur.
Right.
I see the big weekends happening for everyone else.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that I can make that big weekend happen for them.
You're standing on stage and just watching everything.
Conducting the orchestra.
Yeah.
And they're players. They're the...
Do you know John Taffer?
No.
John Taffer is a big restaurant guy and,
okay.
and a promoter. And he comes in. He has a show called Bar Rescue. And he comes in and he fixes people's failing bars. But he also opens a lot of places. And he's got a bunch of places in Vegas. And... just hearing, I mean, I know I had a somewhat of a grasp on the kinds of numbers we were talking about in Las Vegas, but when he started kind of going through, it's like, you know, it could be 50 or 100 bucks to get into a club,
right?
Plus then all the drinks. And if you want a table.
If you're a guy, it's a completely different story than if you're a girl. That's one thing for sure.
Come with extra cash.
Yeah. If you're a pretty girl, it's just the roll out the red carpet, put you on a table with some hungry, thirsty fellas, and then the nice what you want to make it.
But I mean, it's not uncommon for like, oh, it was like $1,000 a person.
Yeah,
in this place.
That's not, yeah. If you want to get a table, you want to show off, and Vegas is all about showing off, you know, quote unquote. So
God, the genius of it is playing to people's egos to give them money. It's so disturbing and perfect. It totally works.
It's capitalism, you know, at its finest, I guess, what you want to call it.
But it's what's kind of interesting is if you live in Los Angeles, you drive around and you see all these names of people. You're like, who's that guy? You're like, oh, he's a DJ. There's all these DJ billboards all over Los Angeles.
Right, right. Yeah.
And then you sort of realize, well, these guys are incredibly well-paid entertainers because of – you can just pop over to Vegas and do a couple of shows, and it's a huge deal.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the main thing that's changed is that now the DJs are actually, you know, making the decisions on how much they're supposed to be getting paid.
Right.
That they're part of the economic structure. Before, the DJ was a fixture in the club. It's just like another reason to go, but they weren't paid properly. They weren't like the reason why people were going to the clubs.
So when did that change, and what was the evolution of being just essentially like a jukebox versus, oh, this person is a real entity that controls the vibe of the room? And when did that happen?
I'd say I can actually give credit to one person, and since we are in LA and we were talking about LA a little bit here, I have to give credit to DJ AM. And DJ AM was one of the he was the first celebrity personality DJ that came from the underground and really showed off his skills, but also was able to play pop culture. These pop culture, he was like a pop culture jukebox, but in a technical way of DJing. He was able to mix all different kinds of genres and do it in a way where people were so amazed. It wasn't like playing iTunes. It was like something was happening that was incredibly special. And then he had this celebrity personality that attracted so many different, you know, so many different cultures and so many different people that that he was the first one to really create an economic structure for DJs. He was the first well-paid DJ in America. He was a DJ that everyone looked up to, like, wow, DJ AM in 2007 or 2008 got a residency making $25,000 a show, and that was unheard of when you're making, I remember at the time, I would get like $500.
Yeah.
And I was happy.
Yeah.
You know, like, because I was making $200 in a bar tab, you know, or maybe $75 in a bar tab at the local bar.
Yeah.
You know, and you look up to those DJs that are like, okay, he's a personality, and he's doing what he loves to do, and the clubs are actually treating him like, this is talent. This is an artist that is going to bring in people, and we have to pay them according to, you know, how many people they're bringing in.
Yeah. So what is it? What is the artful side of it to people who go, oh, what's the? I could just plug my iPhone into a fucking speaker and play a bunch of songs. Like, how do you respond to that, and how do you explain what it is that you do and why it is important in that world?
I mean, there's so many different reasons why you go see an artist. You know, let's like just take like the word artist. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see someone go sing their hearts out, and you see the beauty and quality of their voice, or a band playing their songs, and sometimes the band isn't about being technically the best band, but like they're just raw on that energy that they give off. You know, whether it's those bands or whether it's a DJ. And in many cases, DJs that are popular now are not necessarily known for their technical skill level, but known for their songs.
Mm-hmm.
And the songs, at the end of the day, what I've realized in this being a DJ from playing in bars before I was producing and being a DJ where now my songs have connected to people around the world, the songs themselves are the ones that are the reason why people associate themselves, or they want to go to a party or a club. They're like, oh, I want to hear this DJ's music because they're also representing this culture that I love. And you go for that experience. And once again, that also ties in, like when you go see a DJ and they're representing a culture, it's absolutely more of an experiential feeling. You mm-hmm. you go there to experience something, the sounds of that culture or the songs from that DJ that moved you, just like you would go see a band.
Yeah.
It's different than like rocking out at a show. You know, you go see a band like Foo Fighters and you're just rocking out and then you leave. It's like it's a different kind of feeling because you're there to dance, you're there to be part of, you're there to party, but you're also there to be part of that culture, you know. It's like, I'm going to go see an EDM DJ, or I'm going to go see Questlove playing like, you know, old school funk and hip hop, or I'm going to go see, you know, it's like they're representing different cultures that you're part of.
Yeah.
And, but like, I guess what you're saying is like, what are they doing? Right. What are DJs doing? I mean, we're doing all kinds of things as well. It's like, it's not just, I mean, there's different ways to manipulate and translate your music. You are, once again, you are conducting the
You're controlling the room. Yeah.
And how you control the room is all subjective to you. You yourself are responsible for how the night's going to go. And some DJs are like, okay, this is, I'm going to play my music. I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to play my music, whether you like it or not. And some people are like, get me out of here.
Right.
And then some DJs know, like, you know, like, for example, like for me, when I go into a room, I make a decision. Like, I'm thinking, okay, this is Las Vegas. So there's a lot of people here that know who I am, know Steve Aoki. They're like, oh, yeah, I saw him on Ridiculousness, or I saw him here. I know one song. I don't even know what the song's called. There's a lot of those guys out there, you know. So I'm playing differently. I'm playing, I want to connect with as many people in the room.
Yeah.
You know, and in many ways, I learned that from DJM, to be democratic, you know, to like look at the room democratically and think about how many people you can touch, you know, emotionally connect with.
Yeah.
And then when I play a Steve Aoki concert or show, I'm playing the Steve Aoki songs.
Right.
And I'm doing the Steve Aoki set. And of course, I have to give that the Vegas shows too.
Sure.
You got to give that and then give a little bit different angle, you know, play the songs that they know with your songs.
So you're but you're reading the room and are you going, oh, maybe I'll go this way? Are you sort of following the energy of the...
And you, you have to be able to... I think that's another interesting point, is that you have to be able to, just like when you're on stage and you don't just read off a script.
Right.
You know, you have a script that you know you're going to talk about, but you want to be able to riff off people.
Yeah, because you want it to be organic to the situation, and you want it to
right.
You want it to be a unique experience with that particular audience.
And it makes it special for everyone when you're not like a robot.
Right.
And like, you know, when people are being robotic, you know it immediately. Once you see, like, there's like this line that people just like, when they just follow it no matter what, they can't turn left and right. I mean, eventually, I mean, people aren't dumb. They get it after, like, you know, 60% of the way through, or even less. I mean, if you can riff off things, and like, those are the things that you remember. Those are the things I remember. You know what I mean? Like, I want to remember like the moments where it was something that happened and you're able to take advantage of that moment and be part of the environment.
Yeah. I remember when I was in college, my roommate Will, we got really into raves for a period of time. And it was really it was sort of right when they kind of exploded. And I mean, this was like 91 or 92. And they had just sort of started exploding here. I mean, like the big warehouse ones, where I was like, oh, we're going out to some weird industrial park, and it's, you know, and I remember going, you know, we'd go to Melrose Avenue used to be like the haven for DJs at the time. There were all these like Beats Nonstop, all these record shops.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And
Tower Records on there.
And we would
Santa Monica, or
no, Melrose. Melrose was really all the DJ stores. You could buy turntables there, and you could buy and a lot of the DJs had sections there, and you could buy, you know, like a set by a guy like a guy named DJ Dan. Like, he had this set that you could buy.
Well, Fat Beats.
Yes.
I mean, it's gone, but Fat Beats was like a staple at Melrose. I mean, I was going up there. That was more hip hop and scratch and turntablism, but yeah. But you go there and like you follow different genres, different DJs, and I mean, the culture was so pure and so small, but it was very potent.
Yeah, I mean, and I remember seeing people spinning three turntables at a time, and then just like mixing. I was so fascinated by the mechanics of it.
The technicality.
Because the guys who are really good, it would obviously, I mean, I know I'm just describing DJing now, but it was so fluid and smooth, and it was and the only way that you knew that things were changing was you could see the record come up and
then
the next one, and he have his ear and the thing, you know, but running like three tables at a time.
Yeah. Moving parts that's happening all at once,
because
at the speed.
My roommate Will had a bit of money, and so he bought turntables. And I'm like, this isn't so hard. And I tried it, and it was fucking hard. It was really hard, and it there was obvious, like, oh, okay, this is actually – they make it look easy, but that's what people who are experts do.
Right.
They make things look easy. What do you – so when you're – where are you now? Is there one place in Vegas that you mainly perform at? Do you have a residency at a place?
Yeah, I'm with Hakkasan.
Right. They have all the, a lot of the billboards in town.
Yeah, they're like, they also have Omni as well. They're part of – they own Omni as well. So Hakkasan, MGM, Omni, Caesars are the two clubs that, I'm exclusive with in Las Vegas.
Nice.
So I'm always there. I technically live in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I'm LA. Like, my heart is in LA, and I do my Dimmock, my record label's based out of here. My management's based out of here. But, you know, I'm a Las Vegas resident now.
How long are your sets?
It ranges. You know, like, 90 minutes is like the minimum, but sometimes I've gone like 3.5 hours, 4 hours. But that's if I'm really just vibing, and, you know, but it's generally about 90 minutes.
That's not bad. Yeah, that's a good amount of time.
Yeah.
90 minutes is like that's a good kind of entertainment unit. Like, yeah. A good stand-up show is about 90 minutes, too.
Yeah, yeah, right.
A good, you know, a decent movie is about 90 minutes. Yeah, I know, yeah. A lot of movies now are like, oh, it's like 3 hours. Okay, yeah. It might be too long. 90 minutes is a good entertainment unit. I feel like that's a good arc for people.
Right, yeah. I think for the general non-dance community people, that's a great arc.
Yeah.
But for the dance heads, I mean, some DJs I know, like, their average set time is about 6 to 8 hours.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and it's about stamina. It's about, like, being in a groove. And once you're in this pocket of, like, of where you just kind of stay in this place in your head,
yeah,
you could ride on that wave for a long time and not realize you were riding on that wave for 2 hours.
Well, that's a good, because I feel like that what you're describing happens in everything. Like, there's that moment, that zone that you
exactly.
get into. So do you have a way to get into that? Like, do you know how to get into that really quickly? Because sometimes people, it's a tough place for people to get to, and the more you force it, the less likely you are to get there. So how do you slide into it?
I'll tell you that, like, the DJs that can continue making you feel, or like helping you continue that flow and being in that zone, that is a skill. That's a skill that you have to have. I mean, it's a different kind of DJing. It's like, just like we're talking about with the scratch DJs, there's a skill set on DJs that they make you feel something and make you groove in this space for 6 to 8 hours without drugs.
Good.
I mean, like, for me, it's not even like, you know, of course people are going to do drugs, like, you know, whatever. But, like, for me, I can get in a pocket. And whenever I'm, like, 2.5 hours in and I'm not high on anything but the music, you know, I'm definitely praising the DJ. And I'm just like, wow. And I came from Sao Paulo, and I watched Luciano play. He's, like, an incredible DJ. And this new guy that I heard, Mark Howell, he's another one of those DJs that can throw you in a pocket and just let you ride out for a really long time. It's an incredible, you know, it's incredible to see that happening and feel it.
Yeah. So you pretty much, I would imagine, you know, all the players in the, it's like there, it's a community. Everyone yeah. kind of knows each other.
It's actually, you know, before I was in the rock scene and running my label Dimmock, we've like crossed so many different genres, so many different, and scenes, like the different genres of music, how the bands or artists work together, or they split up in cliques. With DJs, I mean, there was a time when the subgenres of electronic dance music, or whatever you want to call it, were very, very separated. And now the walls have come down, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and a lot of DJs are working together and collaborating on music. And it's not so strange. I mean, there are the purists. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe my DJ that plays music at doo, 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 doo is doing music with this guy that goes doo, doo, doo. And I'm not joking. I'm not joking. Because, like, there's genres of music are specific to the BPM. And if you change your BPM, there's like the purists that absolutely go crazy on you. And, like, it's crazy how the smallest detail.
Yeah, every industry kind of has its own purists, or right, like, yeah, like the hardcore yeah, nerds,
exactly,
who feel like it's their responsibility to define what a thing right, is rather right, than just enjoying things.
Exactly.
But that's what we do with stuff. So is it are there sub cultures who go, well, you know, you should use lighting and effects, or no, you should never do that. It should just be the music.
There's criticism there too. There's criticism on the idea of production.
Yeah.
And how it takes away from the music. And I mean, there's criticism for everything. You know, like I
for a thing that you really should just shut up and enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have to say I'm probably one of the most criticized DJs.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, besides playing music and DJing, I'm also entertaining the crowd by, you know, adding in this idea of throwing cake in your face,
mm-hmm,
or like having a raft ridden over the crowd, which I call white raver rafting, and doing fun little things that are like that I've kind of inherited from, you know, being in the punk rock hardcore scene and like having this no rules attitude, you know, like where it's like the idea is just about having fun,
you know. This makes a lot of sense to me. This makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm sure that this was apparent to you. But I know you're a big Bruce Lee fan, and I know that it's named at. I know that your record label is named at.
Yeah,
but right, that was his thing. Was like, well, can't we just use this interdisciplinary practice of
Jeet Kune Do,
pulling all the best stuff from?
Right.
Why does it? It was the exact same thing. A purist going, no, you can't do that. You right, should just. Well, why? Why can't I do this and this and this and find right, what works best?
Exactly. It's just like, I mean, there are no rules. I mean, at the end of the day, if people leave with a smile on their face and say they had the time of their life, then I feel like it's a win.
That is so – it's so that's great to hear you say thing, that. Yeah, because it – especially – particularly in comedy, you get it a lot too. People go, well, that's not really comedy. It's like, well, it's comedy if people are laughing at it. How about that? If it's fucking fun to – you know, right, like all of this stuff is subjective.
Yeah.
I mean, it's art. It's subjective. And yeah, you as an audience member connect with stuff in different ways because you bring your own baggage to it. I mean, you know, the artist is really just – I think conductor is the perfect – word for it. You're sort of right, conducting the audience's flow, and you know, some people are into that and some people aren't, but it's kind of interesting. And so it doesn't, does it bother you that you get criticized for it? Are you like, whatever, you don't get it?
Well, I mean, I'm human too, you know. If I read a couple of things here and there, it hits me, and but then I like, it's happened enough where you know, I'm a bit wiser, obviously, and
right,
and understand it's just, it could be just this little kid that's just wants to get a reaction. But you know, actually, when you get it from your peers, is that's when I'm like, whoa, like someone that's in the industry and wants to really make it known, then it's like, okay, you know, it's like it's gonna raise attention for me.
Is it super competitive or is everyone pretty supportive?
It's, I'd say 95% very harmonious.
Good.
Yeah, it's not the opposite way around.
Good.
It's there's only a few loud mouth haters out there that I mean, that's just by that their personality. That's
right,
how they are, and they, you know, they want to speak their mind about whatever. And at the end of the day, like, it's an opinion. It's okay. It's like, you know, and that's, I think at the end of the day, that's how you got to accept things. It's like, okay, I don't like this. Okay, cool. You don't have to. It's okay. And, you know, if you want to say, oh, well, I mean, I've said things I don't like, but.
But you do like 250 shows a year or something. It's some insane number like that.
Yeah,
right?
It's kind of incessant, you know.
How often do you evolve your set? Is it ever changing?
Yeah, I mean, the evolution of my set is all based on my music. So at the end of the day, you know what they say with artists, you're known from your last hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of similar with electronic music, except that electronic music culture really dives in to your catalog.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, it's not like a pop based culture where you could be a hit and then you're like nobody afterwards.
Right.
I mean, luckily for that, because it's not like I have hits. You know, like I'm based on songs that people hear about through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God for that, or else I wouldn't have a career. So, and I mean, that's the great thing about the idea that artists now have more control of their destiny or their music than they've ever had before. Thank God for that, because I wouldn't exist. That's why I I do Dimmock Records and my label and support the small guys that are trying to make and break it. That's what I was, and that's what I still am. And so going back to the set, it's like, you know, that's the fun part of this whole process is there is like this show is kind of like the tail end of the process. The beginning end of the process, the beginning start of the process is the production of the music. And the production of the music is influenced by the sounds that are exciting you now.
Mm-hmm.
And
the power of now.
The power of now. And I have a song called "The Power of Now." Actually,
is it based on the Eckhart Tolle book?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I was zenning out. I have a music video, and I'm like zenning out on a hill, which isn't really Eckhart Tolle. He is meditative, but in any case, you know, that's like that process is a lot of fun, and writing music that you're hoping will connect to fans around the world. Which is also another great point that this music is like, you know, majority of the music is without lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
So it transcends not only, languages, but it cultures and it's global and it unites all kinds of people. And you really see it at these huge festivals.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing to see when you play at a festival like Tomorrowland and you look out there at main stage and everyone's donning their flag, and there's actually more countries at this one festival than the Olympics.
Oh my God! Oh yeah, I've seen. Where was it? At maybe it was Glastonbury or something. Maybe it was Glastonbury, but it was going back to the rave days. One of the guys I really liked was the guy behind Prodigy.
Yeah,
and that was such an interesting thing. That it he went, I mean, I assume, I haven't read his bio, so I don't know exactly what he did, but it seemed to me he went from being a DJ to, oh, he kind of assembled a band, and then right, there was a front, but it wasn't, the guy singing.
Liam Hallett.
Yeah.
Well, Liam Hallett, he's not the singer.
He's
but
not the singer.
He's the producer.
He was the producer, yeah. And so Prodigy evolved.
Right.
And
into
then
a band
into a band
right.
from a DJ. But yeah. If you go back and listen to the early Prodigy DJ stuff, it's fucking great.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of great samples in it. And it there's a song called Charlie that I always loved, which people could go back and find on the internet, I'm sure. But, you know, I in a box somewhere in storage, I have all of these old, like, Warehouse Rave 6. And it's just like all collections of.
Right,
but
right.
That was, you know. Do you ever see evolving back to into something? Because you came from a rock background. Do you ever see like, oh, maybe I want to, you know, produce and make this music and kind of front a band and like have a band come in?
The problem with the band structure is that there's a lot of different personalities and different decisions. And I like just having my own little corner and producing my own music. And I don't have to get anyone else to say this is wrong or this is right. I've tried both and I'm happy to do the band thing at some point again, but like it's just when you have control of your own music and you could do it the way you want to do it, it's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I was saying about Prodigy was I feel like there was a Video Music Awards one year where they cut to Prodigy playing. I feel like it was Glastonbury, but I'm not 100% sure, but it was more people than I had ever seen at once in the aerial shot. It just looked like this throbbing organism with the light going.
Right.
I mean, it is different than, I guess, if you're seeing a band. Because if you're seeing a band, you really are focused on the band. But if you're seeing a DJ, you're focused on the music.
Exactly. It's a complete. I'm glad you said that. Because when you're watching a band, like everyone's staring up at the stage. They're head bobbing. They're into it. But they're not into it like they're seeing. When you're at a DJ festival and you see like 40,000 people heaving and jumping at the same time, and there it's not about also another thing too is that with the rock band, it's about the rawness, about like the distortion and the noise and the chaos, and with the DJ it's about hearing music at the best quality at it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be unfiltered. It is filtered. It is made to be the best sound.
Right.
So you're hearing the pristine quality and mixed with the songs that you know from that DJ. And it's about the environment. The DJ is actually 10% of the show when you look up on stage. He's, or he or she. They're this small. And so you see the lights and you see the production, you see the lasers, and you see, and you're surrounded by, you know, tens of thousands of other people at these festivals. Of course, you're going to feel something. It's, yeah, it's, you know, it's something completely different than seeing a rock band.
Yeah, I mean, that has got to be an unbelievable feeling to be standing on a stage and orchestrating that many human beings at one time.
Yeah, the best is that it's like they all become one singular force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they're all jumping together, or they're all like waving together, doing some sort of movement together, whether they're singing along together, they become one gigantic force. And it's incredible.
Like the Borg.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, that's awesome. And especially when they're singing your songs. Like, when I was in Sao Paulo, just, you know, I like duck out the music and you hear them singing along to one of your songs that you wrote like 4 years ago, or whatever it might be. You know, it still hits you no matter how many times you've played it. I've played some of these songs over thousands of times, you know, and it hits you in a different way. You're like, you know, like all these people singing along to the song that, you know, you almost forgot about, you know?
And also the other cool thing is that I'm sure some of the DJs get to live relatively anonymous lives.
Yeah, that's true.
So that there's,
it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, it's different in that way too. You know, it's not like you're plastered like you're Katy Perry or Kanye West everywhere, you know? It's not about your face. It's more about, it's your music.
Yeah.
And like talking about Liam Hallett, or even talking about like Daft Punk, for example, you know, like it's not about who they are, about like who Tomas Bangalter and Guy are, like what they look like. It's about their music and how it's touched so many people.
Right. Forgive me for asking this, if this is really obvious. Did your dad really create Benihana? Is that true?
Yes, he did. Yeah. I mean,
that's fucking crazy.
It's sort of a lie. But my grandfather, he started a cafe in the rubble of World War II called Benihana. And Benihana is the name of a flower that was the only flower that grew through the rubble. Because they had a little cafe, and there was just, it was just in a devastated area, and this flower that popped up was a red flower called Benihana.
Oh wow!
And it wasn't like a teppanyaki, it wasn't like a showman. It was a small cafe with an incredible story of surviving through that period of time. And my father inherited the name and opened up Benihana in New York when he came to America as a. His story is incredible. He came to America as a wrestler and defected from the Olympic group that he was with or something. And he was an ice cream man in Harlem living out there. And he, you know, raised enough money to get a loan to open up a restaurant. And his group, our grandfather came, helped him with the restaurant. And they decided to bring in these tables, teppanyaki grills, to cook in front of people. And that was never done in America, you know, and especially like this is 1940s.
Yeah.
So that's also a really tough, trying time for Japanese people post World War II.
Sure.
So, you know, just his success is an incredible story in itself.
Did you know your grandfather at all?
I didn't because he passed away before my time, but, I heard plenty of stories.
So to hear what it must have been like to be a Japanese immigrant and then a Japanese American,
right,
in that particular time, and still to be able to thrive, to be the flower in the rubble.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty incredible thing to survive.
Yeah. It's incredible to like, you know, I mean, I grew up watching his success, but the strange thing was, is as I grew up, I kind of rebelled against it in a way, you know, like, Benihana is a steakhouse,
mm-hmm,
you know. When I started like understanding who I was or going through my own identity issues as a tween,
mm-hmm,
I found vegetarianism and I was vegetarian, you know, for 15 years, like, you know, kind of not understanding, you know, Benihana as being a steakhouse and, you know, not really wanting to go there. But it's just a strange kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that probably that sounds more in line with your family, like the personality that was sort of handed down of like, I'm going to create my own thing and find my own thing. And I'm going to do a bunch of different things and be an entrepreneur and invent, you know, and create stuff. I mean, it sounds pretty similar.
Right.
You just, you know, your grandfather did it with a cafe. Your dad did it with a steakhouse. And yeah. You're doing it with art. I mean, it's all sounds like it's pretty in line.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's also the kind of father. He's like a tough love parent. So he never gave his kids any money. He never donned us with gifts sometimes, you know. And he's a tough dad, you know. He's a tough dad, and like it was the best thing that he ever did was not actually investing or helping us out financially. And you know, I you have to grow up on your own.
Yeah.
And like that's how he did it. So he had to figure that out himself. So he's not going to, if he spoiled us, I don't think we could have grown, you know, all our siblings, myself included, could have grown, you know, to stand on our own feet and actually do something.
Oh, well, because you would not have been, it's just Darwinian. You wouldn't have evolved
exactly.
to know that you needed to,
exactly.
to do that.
And so it's like, now I'm getting to the age of where, you know, I don't have any kids yet, but, I'm thinking about what kind of dad I would be, and it would definitely be, you know, along the same footsteps, but with, you know, I mean, the great thing is I had a mom mm-hmm. that was extremely caring and so selfless and but she was very compassionate and not in the right ways, in like, you know, connecting human to human, and that was really, really important for me growing up too. So I had like a very tough dad. It was like, you need to figure out how to get to New York if you want to come DJ, or if you need you want money for your, like, it's not like I ever asked him, but because I was always afraid to, but like, you want to start this record label business at when you're 19, you got to figure out yourself. I'm not gonna give you any money, you know, and you know, you just have to do it yourself. You have to get the tools in front of you and figure it out. And if you can't do that, then you got problems. You can't, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, you got to figure that out. Like, yeah, I didn't know how to play guitar, so I got my friend's guitar and I picked up the guitar and started jamming out with my friends. And I didn't know how to record music, so I got my friend's Tascam 4-track recorder and learned how to play all the instruments and record my first demo when I was 16. These are all things, it's like, I didn't get training for a lot of this stuff. I mean, I owe a lot of it to the hardcore straight edge community that I was part of.
Yeah.
Because at that time, it's all about this idea that you can discover, the idea of discovery and being able to take the tools in front of you and make something happen.
Right. Well, it's, you know, it when you look at, and, you know, again, I've probably, we've done almost 800 podcasts, and I've talked to some of the most successful people on every in so many different facets of the world, not just entertainment, but business too, and technology. And we just yesterday had Kathleen Kennedy on, who was a co-founder of Amblin with Steven Spielberg,
right.
And you know, who would later become her husband, Frank Marshall. And she said, you know, Spielberg really loved, even when he got successful, he loved creating limitations and boundaries because it forced him to be more creative, and it gave
right.
him stuff to work around. And it's the same kind of thing you're saying, where having, like, getting the task, like having to figure the shit out yourself
right.
was so much more valuable than someone just handing it to you.
Absolutely. And you have to have the hunger, because everything's built on passion.
Yeah.
And if you're not passionate, then it will fall apart.
Right.
You know, you need to believe in what you're doing. And if it's handed to you, it's more likely than not, it will fall apart.
Right. Because you won't appreciate the value of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's appreciation, value, passion. Those are all the building blocks of success.
Do you kind of – I mean, it sounds like you're either very spiritual or very philosophical or maybe both. But how do you sort of stay focused? Like how do you what is it? Do you have like a daily ritual? Is it a meditation ritual or like a daily gratitude ritual, or what's your thing?
I wish I could give one of those rituals. I don't really have one. I tried meditation, and I could say that that's part of it, but that was later. You know, I mean, that was later in my stage of understanding how to organize and build teams.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, it's the people around you that also believe in your vision
yeah.
that are going to help the vision happen. And so when it comes to business, when it comes to like all the different businesses that I do have, and I have multiple businesses, everything relies on who is in your team and trial and error and figuring out the right decisions and not making the same mistakes again on why you hired that person or not.
Yeah.
And I mean, the teams are absolutely everything. I mean, as far as a ritual, I'd say that would be the ongoing ritual is making sure your team is the right team.
Yeah.
And no matter how many teams I've built, I'm always learning what is the right team, what isn't the right team. I got a team back here.
Is this the right team?
I don't know. Sometimes I have to question these guys.
I'll tell you why this guy's the right team, because he's wearing an ALF t-shirt. Do you see that there's an ALF doll over there?
You know, we're having our 10-year anniversary dinner. We've been working together for 10 years.
Wow.
From when I was a horrible DJ, and he wasn't even a manager. And we're like, let's conquer the world together. And here we are 10 years later, through a million fights and giving him a lot of headache. And him taking a lot of my money, but yeah.
But that's part of the fun part about having to figure shit out on your own is then you're not as afraid to fail because you're like, oh, I tried to build this thing and it didn't work. Or I'll just try this. I'll just try this. Like you really, you know, there's nothing wrong with fucking up as long as you can learn from it and you can try again.
There's success in every failure if you can find the success.
Yeah, and weirdly, when you sort of look back at your life and you go, well, if I didn't like those failures were a gift because if I hadn't fucked up, even though they felt shitty at the time.
Oh my God.
If I hadn't fallen on my face or I hadn't fucked this up or if this hadn't been yanked away, I never would have learned this to then be where I am now.
Right
now. Yeah. So it's
resilience. It's resilience through the failure.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of times
the flower in the rubble.
You know, yeah, it's like morale, man. You get to a point where you're like, I'm done now. I fucking fall on my face so many times. It's like, okay, actually, you know what? You need to stop. You know what I mean? Like, there's a point when, like, you don't want to keep pushing it. You know, because, like, you know, there's the stories where, like, oh, man, I kept trying, I kept trying, I kept trying. Boom, I'm a billionaire.
Right.
But, like, a lot of people that think like they're going to keep trying and become a billionaire, they might not ever do that. They need to stop. They need to like stop and go, maybe this isn't my thing. Yeah, I'm going to try something else, you know, because I think that story hits home more often than not.
I think when that happens, people are more obsessed with the goal and they're not sort of like we were just saying when you're doing a set, they're kind of in robotic mode and they're not listening.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of times if people go,
they're too linear.
Well, you know, I heard anything's possible, but this isn't possible because I couldn't figure it out. And it's like, yeah, but along the way, you need to ask yourself, is this still right for me? Is this still something I even want to do? Is this something that makes sense? You know, is this something that I'm still passionate about? Am I just passionate about achieving this goal for my ego? Or am I really, if you're really passionate about the thing and the process, then it doesn't. Then nothing else matters.
Which goes right back to the power of now.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about the end result. It's about the journey.
Yeah.
So,
always.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, I'm having fun with you right now. So,
oh,
hey, man,
good.
The power of now is fucking
good.
Awesome.
Because you don't, because even if you made that $1 billion, even if you crossed whatever sort of a goal you wanted to achieve, it's not, that thing doesn't change you. What changes you and evolves you is how you got there. Like that's all the learning process.
Yeah, that's why when they ask the 5-year question, I'm like, I have fucking no clue because you asked me 5 years ago, it's definitely not here.
Yeah.
And 5 years before that is absolutely nowhere near here.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you just kind of got to go with what drives you at the moment.
Yeah.
And then make the most of it with the teams you have.
And the struggles suck, but that's where the most growth happens.
Yeah.
That's where you find out who you are, and that's where you really I think it's good for people because I'm sure there are a lot of people like yourself who are like, oh, I want to be a self-starter. I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to build stuff. I want to, you know.
I think that's one of the most probably the most asked questions, especially when people listen to podcasts like this. Like, how do I get there?
We got
like
exactly,
and you can't think about what there is,
right?
So think about what now is, you know, like making now real. Because, like, I mean, I started in fucking a bedroom to a living room, you know, playing shows and fucking. I remember like going on tour with my band, making like, I remember getting $12 for a show,
yeah,
driving 12 hours to play in front of 10 people and literally going, all right, now I need to know everyone's names. And then like, we're going to do this show and then we're going to hang out afterwards. And then I got paid $12 and we had to drive another 12 hours to the next show. And I fucking loved it. I was like, this is why I'm so happy. I'm on the road. I'm playing my music. I'm singing to people who actually know my songs. Like, these 10 people actually cared to come to my show.
Yeah.
And like remembering that too is actually very important.
Yeah, it's great. It's you know, it's kind of funny. Katie, who's our producer, was just mentioning last night just about how, you know, there is kind of an entitlement, I think, with there's sort of a youth entitlement where people, yeah, are like, well, I don't understand why I can't have this thing now. Right. And, you know, and Katie pointed out that I have to give you a microphone for this, Katie, because you said something that never really occurred to me before, which is you go, yeah, and this was one of those like these goddamn kids today kind of conversations. But it was like, you know, there's a generation of kids who grew up in a culture of, we can never tell anyone they're doing anything wrong. We can never, right, everyone, yeah, has to get an award. There's,
yeah,
never.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you said like, you don't learn shit that way.
Yeah, no. I mean, I was like part of it where I saw the difference because I used to play sports when I grew up. And like when I first started, if we didn't get first, second or third place, we didn't get a trophy. We didn't get anything.
Right.
And then I saw it all of a sudden, you're getting participation trophies and everyone's getting the same trophy. And I saw that kid, my neighbor's 4 years younger, and I saw it with him, and they have like commercials and stuff about this now. But yeah, I just started to notice that how like teachers would be more careful about what they would say. They wouldn't criticize you. And now it's just like, it's like you can't say anything to kids. They think that they're all right.
And they sort of grow up a little more entitled than expecting.
They think kind their of shit don't stink. Like they just think everything they do is special and they're perfect. And
that's the bad word right there. Yeah. Entitlement. Yeah. That's like the, I mean, if you even, I think that people need to understand what that word means to themselves and understand like what, like terms like gratefulness or gratitude, and of where you are and how to make that something real. You know, that's the problem, I think, with a lot of people that I've heard, is that don't be entitled to anything. I mean, unless you create it yourself.
Right.
You know, like if you create it yourself, you have every right to be entitled to that. But like, don't be entitled to things that's not yours to be entitled for. You know, it's you have to create your own, you know, your own way.
Yeah, you see it in comedy sometimes where you see young comics and then they're like, you know, man, nobody will book me on the road. And it's like, how long have you been doing stand-up? Like 18 months. Well, fucking, it takes longer than that. Like, yeah, you got to get, you know, like, don't, you can't, right, just expect. And yeah, I'm sure it's the same thing. Like, man, none of the clubs in Vegas are going to book me with DJ. Yeah, you got to get there.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Got to give it some time.
Yeah, like it's funny. Also, like, with everything that's out there, it's always saturation.
Yes.
And it's always going to be saturated.
Yeah.
Especially if people love the art of what it is. If people love like going to clubs with DJs, it's going to be saturated. If people love going to comedy shows, it's going to be saturated. You just got to be doing something different. Be you and do something that's you.
Most people don't even know who you is. Like, they don't even know who they are.
And right. Yeah, yeah.
Like, you rarely ask those questions of yourself. Who am I? What do I want? Like, they're very basic questions, but most people don't ask them.
Right.
Because I think if you did, you might get different answers than what you think you want.
Yeah,
which is such a strange thing.
And if you don't know, then it's always what you want to be, and what you want to be is someone else.
Right.
And that's where it's like you have to stop yourself there and go like, do I want to be Aziz Ansari? Like, no, I don't. I want to be me. But what is me? Yeah, that's a larger question.
It's a big, big, weighty question. But I also think, you know, I think the internet has also activated our instant gratification addiction. And so in as much as you can get anything you want via the internet instantaneously, I think people expect like, well, I should just be really famous now. Like,
right. Yeah. Well, I want to be Instagram famous.
Yeah.
Snapchat famous. But nothing wrong with Snapchat famous people. Actually, like, that's a skill in itself.
Listen, I decided that, and this was completely by accident, mainly I use Snapchat to draw dicks on my fiance's cat.
I think I want to follow you now.
Oh, just really, yeah, really quick, Katie.
Give me my Snapchat. I'll give you a little Snapchat going on. Have you been Snapchatting?
Here. I mean, I don't have any active right now, but here, like this is I've just been drawing on the cat for the past couple of
dude, I got a point.
Wait, let me get it. Okay, so here's
I'm gonna Snapchat you showing me your Snapchat of, okay. of your cat.
Yeah, there's the cat taking a shit on the carpet there. There's the cat surrounded by dicks. Am I doing Snapchat right?
Oh my, that's awesome.
Getting eaten out by Zoidberg, which I thought was
wow,
really
that's
fun.
Actually a really good Snapchat.
Just getting fucked by Stimpy was another one that I was excited
that's a really
about.
Good drawing, I have to say. Like, I mean, I don't even put that much time in my Snapchat.
There's the cat having a dream about taking out Blue's Clues. There's the cat getting jumped on by Mario. There's a cat for Thanksgiving. I mean, this is someone saw this picture. They go, I think I followed someone who's posing as you and just drawing dicks on their cat. And I go, nope, that was me. That was me. That's what I enjoy Snapchat awesome. For. Username Chris Hardwick. Who are you, Steve Aoki?
Aoki Steve.
Aoki Steve.
Yeah, because someone stole Steve Aoki.
God damn it.
These trolls out there. Or not trolls, I guess.
What do you squatters.
Call squatters, man. Squatters. They wouldn't give it up. Actually, I think we try to like Snapchat at them. Like, yo, man, try to be nice.
Hi, my name is Steve Aoki. What is your name?
And I think you sent like a picture of like a turd or something.
That sucks, but it's kind of funny. Is it?
I was like, I'm not gonna give it to you. I mean, you just, you know. Actually, I got my YouTube back. That guy was really nice. I just give a shout out to that
good.
Guy. Yeah, because he was sitting on that, and he was a fan. So I was like, if you're, you know, like, yeah, man, like, I'll give you some T-shirts or something. It's like, oh, sweet.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I got the. I've since given Nerdist to my company Nerdist because we're now. Like, I don't know.
Two beasts,
yeah. I got the Nerdist Instagram a handful of years ago because I sent the guy a limited edition Walking Dead watch.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, nice, I go, is there anything nice. I can give you to get the Nerdist Instagram? And he goes, I saw one of those sweet watches on your show. Can I have that and for my dad? And I go, yeah. So I sent him a Walking Dead watch, and that's how I got the Nerdist Snapchat initially.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So it's pretty cool. Quick question. Do you speak Japanese?
Tododake.
I had started taking tutoring lessons because I want to go to Japan next year.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start.
Oh, by the way, only 5.5% of the population of Japan speak English.
Only 5% of the
population? 5.5% of the population in 2015.
Oh, wow. So I better learn some Japanese.
And so if you leave Tokyo, you're going to be tough place. But the one thing is that the people there are so nice and so thoughtful. And if you're lost, they will take you wherever you're going.
Oh,
and it's
that's
the
great.
Truth. It's, well, like, it's not something that's like a mythology.
I want to make it easier, but I also want to be – I also feel like I want to represent America well, because I feel like a lot of Americans go other places and are like, well, everyone speaks English. I'm like, yeah, but maybe we should try to respect other cultures. So I really want to – you know, I wanted to take Japanese in college, but it was full.
Right.
So I ended up taking Italian because my mom's family is Italian, but I always wanted to learn – I always wanted to learn Japanese.
Hey, what's more important than learning Japanese to go to Japan is just bowing.
Bowing.
Yeah, because that's the sign of respect.
Okay.
And you always bow lower than them.
Do you make eye contact or does your head go down?
I mean, at this point, they know you're a gaijin.
Right,
yes. You know, so like they just – if you just show gestures of just being – it's like it's more humility.
Yeah.
It's more like, oh, like, you know, like kind of like, oh, okay, you've entered the room. I'm just going to be nice and bow and, you know, give you your space. But that's really like – They already know when they see you. They're going to know. And if you start speaking Japanese, they won't understand unless you say arigato or like the, like, you know. But yeah, I mean, go do it. Do it. Learn Japanese.
I
want to
learn it.
Yeah, no, do it.
I really want to learn it. I got to just because it's in just a little bit that I've started studying. And the thing that I love about it is I mean, this as a compliment. It's very mathematical. It's very logical.
Yeah.
The way that it. It's very structured in the way that
I'm doing it really bad, but it's like, you mean, I talk about that when they get mad?
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah.
In the way that English, I feel like, is very unstructured in terms of.
While we're talking, you know, snapping.
Yeah. And then.
Chatting.
And then, don't draw dicks on me. then I feel like it would only be fair because of, you know, what the cat's been going through. You know, it's just a fun, harmless way to fuck with the cat. The cat doesn't know. He doesn't get hurt. People, you know, some people go, oh, the poor cat. Like, he doesn't know. He doesn't know that while he was just lying there on the carpet that tens of thousands of people were watching him.
But you know what? No one's actually making fun of the cat.
No.
That's the beauty of it. It's like, if they were making fun of the cat, then it's a different story.
He's a cool, the cat's real cool.
I mean, no one's making fun of the cat, man. They're making fun of you.
They're making fun of me.
They're not actually making fun of you. They're actually not making fun of anyone.
Yeah. They're probably making fun of the fact that I'm a grown man with a 15-year-old's sense of humor.
Awesome. I mean, I think that's pretty awesome. I love it. I love it. I think it's hilarious. Everyone in the room is laughing, so it's
working. Where are you going to be next? You must be in... Well, first of all, thank you for producing The Hive.
Oh, man. High five on that.
Yes.
That's a high five.
Hive five? Oh, I'm sorry.
Hive five.
No, I apologize.
That was
I don't know.
That was cool.
I don't know if
that was cool.
That was more of a let's enjoy the journey than the goal. but it was. But The Hive was so much fun, and Yarvo was so great. I thought he did such a great job.
Incredible.
And you did such a great job with the music in it. You know, as I my fiance and I watch as many horror things as possible always, and so when we see something that has a fresh take on things, that's talk about saturation. There's so much saturation in horror right now, so when you see something that even feels a little bit different, you're like, oh my god, this is great.
And
Yarvo did such a great job.
His vision from the beginning was awesome. Plus, like, all his, I don't know if you saw his music videos before that he directed, was just so sick, man. He was perfect for the movie.
And then do you think you guys are going to do another one? Do you going to do another one?
I'm not sure. We didn't really get that far last time I met with the team.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was just happy to be involved from the beginning on this one, you know, and meeting with him and meeting with Cary Grant and going over the music. You know, now I'm like doing music for other movies, but this is like my first time really diving in from the beginning.
What's so your favorite thing to do of all the things you do? What's your favorite?
It's a balance. I mean, it's music related. It's a balance between finishing a song that I feel like will affect a lot of people, will emotionally touch a lot of people, and at the same time being able to see it happen by playing it out and you know, being a part of that experience.
Yeah,
because like when you actually see it emotionally affect someone, that your work has actually touched someone and you see in front of you. It's that's I think that's the reason why I'm such a touring, you know, I'm a touring monster, because I love being able to see that all the time.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like that's the most gratifying way of seeing how the art is going out in the world.
It is. It's pretty cool though, because I feel like as a DJ, it's very similar to the way the internet works with entertainment, in terms of, you know, a regular band will get radio play, or like a TV show is on TV.
Yeah.
But the only way the internet content works is that it has to be shareable. Like, people have to talk about it. They have to send it. Oh my God, you'll love this. A community really has to form around it.
Right.
For it to get to the next level and for people to know. And I feel like I feel like it's more gratifying rather than having a big machine just tell people, this thing is good. You should watch
exactly.
it. You know, people really do.
They had to discover.
Together.
They have to discover it as well.
Yeah.
Instead of having, whether it's through their friends or through a community, rather than just like turning on the radio.
Yeah.
And like having it like play you five different times. You're like, okay, now I know the song.
Yeah.
You know, of course I love when my songs make it on the radio, but it's, you know, that's, I don't write my songs for radio,
right.
And luckily I've built a career where I never had to. But of course, when it does, it's like, you know, it's like one of the most epic feelings, like, to hear your song, knowing it's getting played to so many people.
Well, how do you, when you produce for other people or you write or work with other people, how is that different than when you're writing than when you're doing it for yourself?
I'm so concerned about what the Steve Aoki brand is going to represent with my music.
Mm-hmm.
So if I produce a song for another artist, I don't have to think about that. And there are songs where like it's like when you're in the studio, you're not like, you're just going to write what you feel at the time. And it might not be a sound that you want to represent from your brand.
Sure.
So there's like songs where I'll produce it and like, you know what, this works for you. This works for, like, you know, here's a list of artists that I think it would work for. And if they gel with it, then it's their song.
You're just basically talking about, you know, and you mean like your voice. Like, it's basically your voice, that some things work in your voice and some things work better.
I produce a beat.
Yeah.
So if I produce a beat that's like, okay, this represents what, you know, right now I'm working on my next album, Neon Future 3. So I have songs that fit that album.
Yeah.
And I have songs that don't fit it, but I want that music to go with certain artists. So I can give it to, you know, this singer that I think it works well with, her voice. And generally, I like to deliver full bodies of work, because I work with a lot of songwriters as well.
Yeah.
that help write the vocals and top lines on top of my melodies or beats, you know.
Do you think that that modern day entertainers, do you think it's required of them to do the kind of thing that you and I do, which is a bunch of different things? Or do you think that's just, well, it doesn't have to be that way?
No, it doesn't have to be. Because you got to think, there's like artists, let's say that when you're talking about artists in my world that are really, really successful, it's just a personality trait, I think. Because like Calvin Harris, for example, he's an incredible producer. He's going to be known as one of the best producers of our time. And he's an electronic dance guy. You know, he's produces, you know, beats from our world that cross over into pop.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you don't see his name flying all over different things. You know, not to say that he doesn't do it, but you see his name in music.
I mean, it's not, you know, I'm not normally wowed by figures, but they released a figure. It was like, Taylor Swift made X amount of, and Calvin Harris made $66 million. They're like, what the, holy shit.
And that's just music.
That's just music.
It's just music. So it's like, and, you know, for me, it's never been about how much money can I make doing all these other things. It's about what I feel inspired or passionate about. And now I have a platform, which is music, to be able to go and sit with you, hang out with you,
yeah,
you know, in this room, you know, with.
But $66 million is still pretty cool.
Yeah, of course that's cool, you know. But if like, but at the same time, it's like, you know.
But $12 is also cool to you.
But in any case, I don't think Calvin Harris, and I want to speak for him, it's not like he's producing music to make $66 million.
No, of course not.
He's just I've been listening to his music since for a long time, man. That guy is just prolific.
Yeah.
And he's just a hardworking musician, songwriter, singer. He does everything. He's incredible.
And he's probably not thinking about the money either, because you can't. I mean, he couldn't. I don't think you'd be able to continue. If you got that in your head, I don't think he'd be able to continue to.
He doesn't have to think about money.
He doesn't have to think about it.
He doesn't have to, ever.
He doesn't have to think about it.
He just thinks about the next really nice expensive thing he wants to buy and know that he can do it. You know? I mean, that's like the great thing. It's like there's no, like, okay, I'll just buy a jet if I want.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. You know, I don't need to fly commercial anymore or something.
But, again, you know, yeah, that's all fine and good and everything, but it is all about passion. And like I was sort of joking about before, you know, the $12 that you made to perform for a handful of people and had to drive 12 hours. I mean, emotionally, that's probably more rewarding than if someone just gave you a bunch of money. You know what I mean? Like it because that really.
Money is a tool at the end of the day. It's a tool to get things. And there's people that had $300 million and like Mike Tyson, they're just gone. It was all gone. And he
doesn't make them happier, doesn't solve their problems.
It's just a tool to get stuff, you know, like stuff that you probably don't even need. And the most amazing things in life are free. Yeah. I hate to say it like that, but it's what's in your head, what makes you happy, the people that surround you, that you have to make the right decisions in your life, or the people that surround you that make you happy.
Yeah.
What makes you happy? It's not things. Yeah, right. It's nice to drive a really expensive car, but I'd rather hang out with people that like actually care about me and that want the best for me, and I care about them, want the best for them, and I want to be creative and do things that are going to emotionally touch people.
Yeah,
and that is powerful.
Well, I'm sure people are like, "Well, shut up, you guys made money doing work, so fuck you." I don't have, you know.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
No, I do. Yes, but I also believe that I think people place too much emphasis on it. And that it doesn't. So it solves some problems, but it does not solve all problems.
Yeah.
And you still need to do the things that you're passionate about. And I just think if rather than someone said, well, my goal is to make $1 billion, like that's not the, what you should be asking is what's going to make me happy, because ultimately, you know, you have to live with yourself every day.
Yeah. And also, you know what, like, just to like play devil's advocate, because, you know, we both make money for what we do. Hey, man, I made money and I bought myself a crazy house in Vegas because I never thought I could. And right. I did it with my own money and I was proud of that.
Yeah.
That's my money that I made and that was sitting in a bank. And now I put into something where I turned this house, my house, into my dream home. Mm-hmm. I have a foam pit in there. I have I have a super trampoline. I have a 16-foot deep pool that I could jump into whenever I want.
Are you in the sequel to the movie Big?
Yeah, basically that's me. You know, like
Josh Baskin.
Like, you know, like if I'm gonna get, if I, like this is my house, I'm gonna make my dream house.
Yeah,
but, I mean, of course, I'm gonna share it with like my family or what, my future family.
Also, you do. I know that you do charity work. I know you do a lot of great charity work too.
Of course, and like, you know, and I mean that's once again, that's going towards like this platform that we have of influence,
mm-hmm.
and that's how we can actually spread, you know, awareness and information, not just raising money. I think it's also important to talk about these things that people don't really know about, like whatever it is, you know, like, you know, in my world, like, you know, if you look in the club world and the festival world, people are having the best times of their lives. And a lot of them don't know about like, you know, the stuff that I'm interested in. Like I could be able to kind of bring that demographic over. And maybe 1% of the population of the demographic will have an interest in helping people with brain degenerative diseases, or, you know, the stuff that we're doing right now.
Yeah. Oh, what are some of the things? Like what sort of charity work is important to you?
Right now it's really about like brain health, mm-hmm. and brain research. And I've been like, my album's called Neon Future, and that's all based on looking at science and technology and, you know, where we're using it to, you know, better our lives, make our brains more creative, or live longer and healthier lives. And I was able to bring on scientists and other futurists that are, you know, versed in their fields on the album. And in so doing, I wanted to also, that's a musical composition of what Neon Future is. I wanted to make a companion set interviewing these futurists, talking to the scientists, and then also raising money towards the research, mm-hmm. that these people are doing on like, for example, Aubrey de Grey, who has an organization called SENS, and they're like trying to reverse cellular degeneration, and they're, you know, like that's their research, is understanding why cells break down, they overpopulate, mutate, and, you know, do research on that. It's like, you know, the end goal being, you know, if we can reverse cellular degeneration, we won't age. Our organs won't fail, or can't like, you know, cancerous cells won't become cancerous, or cells become cancerous won't become cancerous, mm-hmm. and really interesting stuff like that. That you think, you know, going back to when I was a kid, I read comic books because I was obsessed with the science fiction about the future. And now things are happening 2015 that
are fulfilling that.
Yeah. And I love reading about that. So, you know, sorry, it was a long one for that, but
no,
yeah, it's like at the end of the day, it's science and what we're doing right now and technology is exciting. And I want to put more emphasis on that, more awareness on that, raise money towards that.
Excellent. Well, this has been an amazing chat. Thank you so much for coming in. Excuse me. So follow your passions, people. Be the flower that grows in the rubble. Be the Benihana flower that grows in the rubble.
Right.
And also, make stuff. Just make your own stuff.
Yeah, make stuff. I think that's the best, is be creative.
Make stuff.
Be creative. And, you know, I'm glad that we talked about the idea of being yourself and what is that, you know? And I think that's the question, is like, who are you?
Yeah.
How do you find that? And
try things. You try things. You
try
make stuff.
A lot of things.
You know, because a lot of times, one of the great things about art, about making art, is not so much just to affect other people or to get attention or whatever, but also making art tells you a lot about who you are, because you don't realize – sometimes you don't – a lot of times, actually, you don't realize what you're saying until you make something and just spit it out and go, yeah. Oh, wow, I guess – this is a piece of who I am, and I didn't realize that until I manifested it into the real world.
Right.
So thank you for doing that, and thank you for letting us get on board the Hive with you. And
that was awesome.
And
yeah.
and
high five.
High five.
High five.
Thank you for bringing it back around and making me feel less ridiculous. I appreciate that. All right. Enjoy your burrito, everyone, which is our way of saying enjoy, live in the now.
Power of now.
The end.
Burrito. Live in the burrito.
Live in the burrito.
Just jump in that burrito.
Jump in the burrito. Get all up in there. What's in your burrito? That was too much like a Capital One commercial.
I was waiting for like Chipotle.
That's if Chipotle gets bought out by Capital One. What's in your burrito? All right. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.